You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Macon Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN with Ed Maher and Ken Edwards. Now, in the initial segment, I mentioned a study that I had read, and we're lucky to have one of the authors of that study on the phone with us today. His name is David Madland, and David is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Welcome.
And he's also the author of Reunion, How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. So welcome. Thanks for coming on the show, David.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's talk about the article first. And before we do that, David, you work for basically a think tank, correct?
Yes.
Center for American Progress, think tank. It's been around for about 20 years. You would say if it had a polar opposite, what would the other think tank be?
Heritage Institute or American Enterprise Institute.
So those are largely like
right wing think tanks.
Yeah, the old Koch brothers money funded think tanks.
Right. So it's good that there is a counterbalance to that, if you will. And you yourself, what's your background?
My background, I've worked for labor unions. I've worked for a member of Congress who was chair of the Labor Committee when I was there, and worked on political campaigns, but I also have the academic side of PhD. And so I've sort of kind of a hybrid between politics and union sort of work, as well as the academic.
There is a Venn diagram that has all of that included, and you must fit right smack in the middle of that.
And the Washington Post actually called you one of the nation's wisest labor scholars. That's pretty high praise.
That's very kind of them. sometimes happens. More often they'll say bad things about me. But
that's all right. And the Washington Post, owned by?
That would be Jeff Bezos,
that's
right?
Yeah. And where did you go to school?
I went to Berkeley for undergrad, and I got my PhD at Georgetown.
Nice.
So what, online? Those are online schools?
Georgetown. I think I've heard of that one.
They just give them to everyone.
You know, it's a nice thing that the kids can get online education nowadays and look where you could wind up.
So the study that you put together that I came across the other day was titled Unions Build Wealth for the American Working Class. And one of the first things that I saw in the study was a definition of working class. I mean, I always assumed that I grew up working class, but I didn't know what it actually meant. So can you define working class, like how you define the American working class?
Sure. In this study, you know, we define it as people without a four-year college degree. There's certainly other ways you could think about it, whether it's an income level or the type of, whether it's blue-collar work. But this is kind of a definition that lots of academics and sort of political people use, because there's often a sort of a big difference in the sort of kind of income you can earn and the lifestyle you have if you have a four-year degree versus if you don't.
And so, I mean, the findings of this, quickly summarized, would just be unions, the outcomes for union members in the working class versus non-union members in the working class are dramatically different. Unions are extremely beneficial for that group. Could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, so they're big. And as you were writing, the typical working class union household has about 200,000 in wealth, and that's four times the typical wealth for a non union working class household. So these are big differences.
And you're talking about what, property, you know, money in the bank, you know, your house, etc., right? I mean, that's what you're talking
about.
All
of that. Yeah, so wealth is kind of the it's add up everything that you've got that's positive, your savings accounts, your house, your retirement accounts,
your pension,
subtract out anything you owe, subtract out anything you owe, and it's the sort of this net thing. It's kind of a lifetime sort of accumulation of everything you've been able to earn. It's not just what you got one year that you had a good year, you earned something. It's like a really what you got in the bank.
Yeah, I think that goes along with, you know, the studies that say, you know, most Americans are one catastrophic incident away from, you know, bankruptcy or homelessness.
Right. I think the study mentioned that one in three Americans still can't handle an unexpected expense of $400.
Yeah. So what happened?
Yeah. So that's scary. That's sort of how that's, you know, that puts into sort of perspective that when you think you're living the paycheck to paycheck, it's because you don't have any wealth to rely on. Yet when you're part of a union, it's transformative, and it's transformative because, you know, probably there's lots of other studies that looked at the good things unions do, like like they have high, you have higher incomes, you have better benefits, you also have a more stable job. Mm-hmm. And this study, really what it shows is that all of those add up to be so much greater, because it's not just one thing unions do. They do all of this stuff, and that means a whole lot more financial security for you.
And thinking about this in terms of wealth, I mean, we talk all the time about hourly pay and annual pay being better under a union contract, but a term that you use in the study, the union wealth effect, I think it makes me think about it in a different way, because one of the points that you make in the study is children of union members earn more during their lifetime. So this is, unions are creating a foundation for working class people that benefits the next generation and the next generation. So you're really building a family or building something like a strong foundation for your family to continue on for multiple generations.
Yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head there. And that's what, you know, when you think of sort of typical person without a four-year degree, that means they didn't necessarily, they probably didn't have a lot of family wealth. They didn't have sort of the, you know, a fancy college degree and sort of the benefits that might bring. So how do they take care of their family? How do they sort of pass something on? Other people, whatever, they can pass on their estate or whatever fancy things they have. But for a typical person working, a union is sort of an essential way to do that, because you set yourself up with some wealth, and that wealth can then provide all sorts of benefits for the next generation.
And like your kids are healthier, like, you know, here in Chicago and around the Midwest, and I'm sure in other parts of the country, you know, you're seeing, and both Ed and I come from the building trades, David, and you're seeing, you know, we're opening doctor's offices and, you know, getting people in, and they're healthier and their kids are healthier. Ed told me that union household, you know, members live longer, right? They're literally healthier. So, you know, it's just,
yeah, and
it's
these
just,
are, you know, these are the kinds of, I think studies are getting a little bit more into these kind of things of because wealth, the other thing here is just wealth is so much more unequally distributed than income.
It's, right,
you know, like
right,
hundreds of times more unequally distributed. And so that means the life chances for people are so much different. But if you can build a little bit of a nest egg, like unions help you do, these have sort of benefits from so many facets of your life. That's, you talked about health, and these kind of things are being more and more just studied. Or I, you know, mentioned mobility, passing on advantages, so your kids can then have the kind of advantages that someone who has a college degree has, for example. So that's one of the other findings from this study. The typical working class union household has almost as much, not quite, but almost as much wealth as the typical college-educated non-union household. So they're almost closing the gap with the college-educated.
Wow. And I got to tell you, I think that you'll see that shift over the next, you know, 10 years,
yeah,
if not sooner, because we are preaching earn while you learn, come mm-hmm. to an apprentice program, don't come out with debt. And as these college degrees, in my humble opinion, become less and less useful, I think you're going to see a sea change in that. I want to switch gears, though, if you don't mind, to talk about your book. I actually did download it last night, and I read the introduction. It's radical. I mean, it's absolutely radical. So, you know, you talked about the fact that there needs to be a sea change here in America in terms of labor law, labor policy, et cetera. Can you just touch on a couple of those points?
Sure. So my goal is most every worker should be covered by a union contract, by a collective bargaining agreement. So that means everyone can benefit from all of these things we've been talking about, the greater wealth, the having ability to have your family have security and the like. And so then how do we achieve that is what I really want to focus on.
Right.
And to me, there are a couple things you need to do. And the first is about getting far more workers to be members of unions. And that's about giving workers stronger rights, things like the PRO Act, but it's also about really how you incentivize people to join unions so that we can have membership rates like some of the countries like in Sweden, for example. But we also then, I think, want to improve how we bargain so that we're covering far more workers.
So that's when you come to the sectoral bargain is what you called it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and explain
exactly
what that means.
So
what does that mean?
Yeah, so most of our bargaining in the U.S. is worksite by worksite.
Right.
But when unions are really dense, like you think of the old auto industry, they had mm-hmm. something close to sectoral bargaining where they covered kind of all of the workers in the industry, and the gains sort of spread out from there. So everyone in the shop got a good union contract. And that means that the firms don't need to fight unions so much, because they're going to pay the same rate kind of whether no matter what.
Right, exactly.
It also means, which is sort of that's you know one of the things that unions have been fighting for a long time, is similar pay for similar
equal pay
work.
For equal work. Absolutely.
And it's really hard to get that when you're bargaining just with an individual work site. If you can get to a broader level, right. And you know, you come from the trades. One of the things I talk about is prevailing wages are
absolutely.
Sort of one of the few things we have that are a little bit like what I want, but I want it on a much bigger scale.
So do we.
So in prevailing wage law, when you're working on doing construction on a government contract,
yep.
Typically the firm has to pay at least the prevailing wage, which when unions are strong, that's the union rate.
Right.
And so all of those workers are benefiting, but also the union is benefiting because their wages aren't getting undercut. Your wages aren't getting undercut.
That's right. And our contractors are not getting undercut.
Exactly.
Right.
And so your firms are succeeding and can compete.
So you're saying to take that and take it to its logical conclusion, which is you do it across a sector, right? Whether it's a service sector or a manufacturing sector or whatever. So sectoral bargaining, that's number one. You also say, which is something that Ed and I have been saying since the day one of this show, that the labor policy and the penalties for breaking the law here in the United States are laughable. It's a joke, right? And that needs to change.
It's a crime. It's criminal, of course. Yes. Absolutely. We need real penalties for firms that violate the law. Otherwise, there's no disincentive for them to, go on as they do. As you probably heard on your show before, the penalties right now are laughably weak. That firms sometimes refer to these as, quote, their hunting licenses. It's just a permit that they have to post. Practically, there's nothing deterring them from all sorts of horrible union busting activities. And that needs to stop. But I'm also for, we need to go well beyond that. Like, that is just not enough. It's not just enough to say you can't do this. We want to really encourage workers to get into unions. So you mentioned these apprenticeship training programs that
yes.
you all do, which
yep.
I think are, one of the best things we've got going. You earn as you learn.
That's right.
But as you know, it's also a pipeline for people to get into your union.
Yes.
And so I want to ramp that up and things like that as well. So we're really incentivizing, encouraging people.
And in the process, you build a more skilled workforce for the nation.
And then we have, there's greater productivity gains. So there's a bigger pie and we can get more of that bigger pie.
So, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned in your book from what Ken was telling me is that the political arena here is someplace where workers are not winning. What we see is that unions make a huge difference no matter who you are. They will make your life better. And yet we have a Republican Party that often nationally is pushing policies that are against unions and often against workers, and the Democratic Party, which frankly I think is just distracted from these kitchen table economic issues and focused on things that maybe fall outside of Maslow's old hierarchy of needs. So, I mean, what do you think needs to happen on the political front to kind of open the floodgates here?
Well, I think you started to get it right. Labor issues have to become front and center. They can't. We can't be distracted by all these sort of cultural issues that are dividing Americans. We all want to find how to make work pay and put that front and center. And there's starting to be a shift. It's nowhere near enough, but there's been some big movements that I think, are important to note. So the public opinion right now on labor unions is more popular. Labor unions are more popular than they've been almost ever.
Right.
Approval ratings around 70%.
Yeah.
Union, so the public
yeah, no question
is
about
there.
It. And the unions
the
won 80% of their elections last year. I'm going to mean to cut you off, but and we don't have a lot of time left, but you said something, that I think is something that Ed and I have been saying, that when you take out the gun issue, the gender issue, whatever it is, the woke issue, blah, 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 all this kind of nonsense that, like you said, is dividing this country and doing a very good job of dividing us, by the way. And you take that out and say, hey, how about this worker amendment on the ballot? So here in Illinois, we passed the Workers' Rights Amendment. Every single county.
Thank you.
Every single county in this state, deep, deep red Illinois, voted in favor of the Workers' Rights Amendment.
Yeah.
Right? So moving everything off to the side, like you said, David, focusing on labor and workers' rights, that has to be the center of attention. And what Bernie Sanders is doing, I think, is important, right? Holding some CEOs accountable and having hearings. It needs to get labor and workers' rights has to get into the vernacular of the American people and politics and culture, you know, and radio shows and television shows and, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your book and what you're doing, I think, is important in that regard. You know, I would encourage everybody to go out and Google this, buy this guy's book, because, you know, it's absolutely fantastic.
And that book again is called.
I, of course, agree. Like, we got to make union issues the center of sort of political debate.
Agreed.
Yeah, and the book again is called Reunion: How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. And we've been talking to David Madland, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. David, I know you've got to run. Thank you so much again for making some time for us this morning.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
We'll be right back right here on the Workers' Mic, 720 WGN.